local news, culture, and NPR.
Live from the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, the New York State budget is technically due in 1 week, which means it's crunch time in Albany. Legislative leaders and the governor are working to find compromises on many thorny issues, but with so much still up in the air, will they pass the budget by April 1st? We'll hear from Senate Finance Chair Liz Krueger to unpack some of the most watched budget items. Science stories with Joe Johnson. Our retired Port Jervis science teacher shares some science news making headlines, including a fossil named after Kermit the Frog, planetary ingestion, and smelly teens. Yeah, you heard that right. And Sullivan County Democrat health and wellness columnist Maggie Fitzpatrick is here with her Moving Toward Health column, Secrets of Great Supporters, and poetry workshop exploring the comfort of words. New contributor Tracy Gates has the story. First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Several teams in the Baltimore, Maryland harbor are continuing to search for anyone involved in the major bridge collapse overnight. The Francis Scott Key Bridge fell into a river underneath after a huge cargo ship ran into a bridge piling. Baltimore Mayor Brandon Scott says authorities are looking for at least seven people.
Everyone, this is an unthinkable tragedy. We have to, first and foremost, pray for all of those who are impacted, those families. Pray for our first responders and thank them, all of them working together, city, state, local, to make sure that we are working through this tragedy.
The FBI has sent agents to the scene, but officials say there is no evidence of terrorism. The National Transportation Safety Board says it has established a special team to investigate the bridge collapse. Abortion is back at the U.S. Supreme Court today. This time, doctors who oppose abortion are challenging Food and Drug Administration regulations. These rules have made abortion pills far more accessible over the past 7 years. As NPR's Nina Totenberg reports, there is more at stake in the case than abortion rights.
At issue is the entire structure of the FDA's regulatory power to approve drugs, continually evaluate their safety, and lift restrictions found to be unnecessary. It's a system that until now has been widely viewed as the gold standard for both safety and innovation in this country and around the globe. Siding with the FDA is virtually every major medical association in the country, as well as the pharmaceutical industry regulated by the agency, and even the private watchdog group that has often criticized the agency. All see the case as an existential threat to the pharmaceutical industry's ability to develop new drugs and the FDA's ability to evaluate drugs scientifically and objectively. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
Stocks open higher this morning as the Commerce Department reported a rebound in durable goods orders last month. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose about 33 points in early trading.
Orders for long-lasting manufactured goods rose 1.4% in February, thanks in part to a big jump in demand for commercial airplanes. The rebound was stronger than forecasters had expected and follows a drop in durable goods orders the two previous months. Excluding transportation equipment, February orders rose 0.5%. Coffee and donuts are a popular combination, in particular McDonald's coffee and Krispy Kreme donuts. After a successful test launch at 160 Kentucky restaurants, McDonald's plans to start offering Krispy Kreme donuts nationwide. The phased rollout will begin later this year. The announcement put a shiny glaze on Krispy Kreme stock. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow has now turned negative. It's down about a point. You're listening to NPR News. The founder of the online site WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, has won a temporary reprieve from a British court. The British judges have blocked his extradition to the U.S. for now. Assange faces espionage charges in the U.S. The U.K. judges want to make sure he won't be eligible for the death penalty in the U.S. The Justice Department is challenging the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation over a ban on facial hair, the agency says, provides no exceptions on the basis of religion. And Pierre Sandia Dirks has more.
Many peace officers and even the U.S. military have bans on facial hair, but they also have exceptions for people whose religions require them to grow beards, like Sikhs and Muslims. CDCR, which includes everyone who works in a California prison, implemented a revised facial hair policy last year. The Justice Department says they've repeatedly denied religious accommodation requests from Sikhs and Muslim staff. The DOJ says that's unconstitutional, and it's now challenging CDCR in court. A bill that would require CDCR to make religious exemptions for facial hair is also winding its way through California's legislature. Sandhya Dirks, NPR News.
The Internal Revenue Service says there are tax refunds from 2020 that are worth more than $1 billion, and they have yet to be claimed. The IRS says about 940,000 people in the U.S. have yet to claim the refunds. There is a deadline. People who want to receive their unclaimed refunds have only until May 17th to take action. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Cigna Healthcare, a health benefits provider that advocates for better health through every stage of life. Learn more at Cigna.com. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Negotiations for the state budget are underway at the New York State Capitol in Albany. While the governor and legislative leaders attempt to come to an agreement on a myriad of issues, including housing, taxes, health care, and education, it's unclear whether or not they will meet the impending April 1st budget deadline. From the New York Public News Network, David Lombardo sat down with State Senate Finance Chair Liz Krueger to unpack some of the most watched budget items.
So in the One House budgets proposed by the Democrats in the Senate and Assembly, the spending that they envision is above and beyond what the governor called for in her executive budget. In order to pay for that, the Democrats in the legislature have advanced higher taxes on wealthy New Yorkers. In the Senate in particular, there's an increased income tax on New Yorkers making more than $5 million and above, as well as an increase on corporations making more than, I believe, $5 million annually. Why is that the right balance to strike for the Senate Dems in particular, the increased spending and the increased taxes?
Well, to start, nobody ever wants to increase taxes, but you need to provide the services and the programs that the people of New York need. And we believe that we made very modest proposed increases in a number of different sources of revenue. You mentioned two. One is an increase in taxes for people making over $5 million a year, and then a bump if you make more than $25 million. Well, just to start, this is your taxable income, which anyone who has $5 million or $25 million of taxable income has dramatically more actual income, because there's so many ways to shelter income and to not take income as quote-unquote cash when you have that level of wealth. So the changes we made would have absolutely zero impact on the lifestyle or the spending ability of anyone in these categories. These people have, you know, they are the 1% of the 1%, and they actually don't spend that kind of money, and they're earning it at a much faster and higher level than actually they will probably ever spend. So we feel very comfortable saying we need some additional funds for important programs in New York State. We're asking you to, yes, make the sacrifice of paying a little bit more in your taxes, but we're very confident we'll have no impact on their lives. Now, on the corporate tax, it's also only if the corporation nets more than $5 million a year. So these are quite large corporations, and the majority of them aren't even actually here in New York. They're national and international companies that sell to us in New York, and they will continue to sell to us in New York. But it's not even a storyline of, well, would they pick up and leave if we have a higher tax rate on them? It has nothing to do with small or medium or community or local-based businesses. So again, we believe that that is an appropriate decision. And in fact, our corporate taxes on high-earning large corporations is lower than quite a few states.
And those taxes are going to generate potentially billions of dollars in additional revenue. So can you talk about what the Senate Democrats in particular envision spending those additional dollars on?
Sure. So we think those two tax combined tax proposals will bring us in about $2.2 billion a year combined. And we have a full and robust package of changes to the governor's budget. I'd say one of the biggest discussions has been around not allowing cuts in public school funding. The governor proposed fairly dramatic cuts in public school funding that would impact 50% of the school districts in the state. Now, school districts function under knowing what their budgets are year after year, being able to hire or keep the staff they have. And the concept that in one year you would cut 50% of the school districts would literally leave them in a crisis at this moment, because they've already made their decisions and their plans for what next school year starting September 1 looks like. So for 50% of the districts to face reductions in the amount of money they're getting in state aid would truly be damaging and impact, you know, half of the state of New York. So we put that money back. Last year, we, in agreement with the governor, adjusted the funding to finally meet our legal obligations to fully fund the formula base aid to every school district in the state. We spent decades fighting in court around this issue. We made commitments that then got pulled back because of economic problems and then the pandemic. Last year, we finally made the commitment to deliver full funding aid as committed to in previous years to every one of our school districts. And it's a year later, and the governor proposed reducing that commitment. We just thought that was wrong and would harm school children and their families. So we're putting that money back. That's one of the biggest changes we're making in the governor's budget. We also, in coordination with the assembly, actually found an opportunity to draw down $4 billion more from federal Medicaid funds. So it's not new taxes on the people of New York State. It's new federal money coming to us. It has to be spent on healthcare-related activities for people eligible for Medicaid. But interestingly, that was another place the governor was calling for significant cuts, even though the healthcare providers, hospitals, community-based healthcare, nursing homes, doctors, nurses were all explicitly talking to us about the impacts of having such low Medicaid reimbursement rates, our difficulties finding people to work in our hospitals and nursing homes and home care services. So we know we have a growing population that's getting older. We know we have higher health care costs. I wish we didn't, but we know for a fact we do. And this $4 billion more that we'll be able to draw down from the federal government is going to go a long way to addressing those concerns. But there's no tax increase on the people of New York. I think that is a complete win-win. And I would hope the governor would go, what a great idea they came up with.
With regards to the creative way of tapping into additional Medicaid dollars, any concerns that after that money runs out, you've now created this new baseline of healthcare spending that you won't be able to cover with federal dollars, and then the state's going to have to dig into its own pockets to find that money?
So we believe that this waiver we will apply for and get, because they just gave the same waiver to California, is a three-year waiver. We would know long in advance if there was the potential for it to continue or not. We would know that we might have to deal with a hole or change our funding. We have to do that every year. We have zero-based budgeting every year in this state. And every year, I've been around now for 22 years, every year at some point before budget starts to get negotiated, somebody discovers we're in better shape or worse shape than we imagined. But it's always a surprise. Every year, it's always a surprise whether we're doing better or worse and why. And then we deal with it. And I've had years where we had to make budget cuts, and they're very painful. I've had years where we've had to cut as much as $10 billion out of our annual budget. No one wants to do it. But in fact, it is the model of government that we have when we do annual budgets, and we have to evaluate every year whether we have the funds or not. Now, you could ask the question, do we just have too much money being spent on health care? It is the fastest growing piece of the budget. And there are lots of questions about it. And we need to confront that, because we also need to confront the fact that demographically we're becoming an older and older population, and older people have new costs and more costs. So yeah, they're challenges. They're always challenges. But I think that's what we get elected to do, face the challenges and come up with the best answers we can.
Going back to education aid, is it safe to assume that even if the Democratic majorities in the legislature can't negotiate some sort of increases in revenue with the governor, that there will be additional dollars spent on education above and beyond what the governor proposed, in part because of what we saw from the joint revenue forecast, which identified another $1.3 billion above and beyond what the governor projected our revenue would be for the coming year, and other positive financial indicators we've seen since then, including a really good sales tax report for the month of February. So is it safe to assume that there will be additional dollars for education no matter what happens on the revenue side?
I don't feel comfortable saying anything safe to assume.
Even after 22 years?
Even after 22 years. This is a process that goes through negotiation between the two houses and the governor. If you ask me the question, what issues seem to often stay on the top of our lists of priorities? Yeah, public education for our children seems to always be at the top of our list. There's not one part of New York State this doesn't impact. There's not one person in New York State, whether they have children in the school system or not, who's not impacted. I talk all the time about what are the things the state needs to deliver to make sure that we are a healthy, growing state. And the punchline is infrastructure, clean air, clean water, and an educated workforce. That's what brings businesses here. That's what keeps them here. So even people out there who say, my kids are raised, I don't have anyone in the school system, why do I have to care anymore? Because whatever business you're in, you won't have educated people to work for you unless we have a good school system. Whatever business you're in, you aren't going to be able to sell to any customers if they don't have the education they need to get jobs and provide for their families. So education is just a universal fundamental assignment of government. So yes, I don't believe there will ever be a time where we won't prioritize the importance of a good quality education for everyone.
Well, finally, for the second year in a row, there seems to be an effort to strike some sort of grand bargain on both housing creation as well as increased tenant protections for New Yorkers. Over my right shoulder, I noticed you have a copy of the 2019 really ambitious housing law that was spearheaded by the two houses in the Capitol here, by the Senate Dems and the Assembly Dems. As part of the conversation that's going on right now, landlords and property owners are looking to scale back some of those protections in order to strike this grand bargain. Are you comfortable with rolling back any of the tenant protections or rent stabilization issues in particular in order to achieve some deal on new housing and other tenant protections, like something about the principles of good cause eviction?
So no, I don't believe that my house or the other house has any intention to scale back the law we passed in 2019. It took us, in some cases, 40 years to make those changes, and we watched the damage made to affordable housing in New York State over those 40 years, particularly in New York City, where the rent stabilization laws mostly apply, although they also apply in Nassau County and Westchester, and I believe Syracuse, I think. So no, we're very, very happy with the law changes we made. Yes, we think there need to be more tenant protections. That law from 2019 has nothing to do with the rent costs of market rate housing. And so the tenant protection being called for desperately is to change the rules of the road on ability to evict people in market rate housing. You'll still be able to evict if they don't pay their rent. You'll still be able to evict if they are bad tenants and are causing problems for your property and their neighbors. But otherwise, we're saying, let's have a reasonable formula for how much you can raise their rent on an annual basis so that we aren't seeing continued growth of evictions of people who did nothing wrong the rents are just growing faster than they can possibly afford them. That's bad for everyone. Now, why is the rent going up so much, so much more than, you know, even the inflation levels or COLA levels? So partly it's greed by some. We can do it. We can make more, so let's make more. And it's also fundamentally, we have more people looking for housing than we have housing in certain parts of the state, not just New York City. We're hearing about these issues all over the state of New York now. The solution to prices being too high in housing is to build more housing. My legislative colleagues completely understand and agree. We need to build more housing, not just in New York City, but throughout the state of New York. We have put together a robust package in our One House bill to try to support increasing the type of housing and the number of units being built throughout the state of New York. We believe strongly that we need to help build ourselves out of this problem. The challenge is how much government money is available to subsidize that effort, and where is it going to be used? So I believe that real estate in some cases is asking for too much in exchange for building us affordable housing, and they're asking for money to build non-affordable housing. And I don't agree with that. I'm totally prepared to support government and tax investment through programs like 485, ABCDE, whatever we're calling it this week, and other models for supporting the affordable housing to be built. But we need legitimate partners in this deal that are actually giving us affordable units. If you just subsidize real estate to build non-affordable housing, as we did under the old 421A program, they build lots of unaffordable housing in poor communities and push out the people who have been living there, and you end up with the gentrification disasters we have seen in New York City for the last 20 years. We need to get it right. We really believe we need to get it right. We think we've put together a package that gets us closer there. Obviously, this is going to continue to be negotiated. We're not walking away from the table. We didn't last year. We're not walking away from the table this year. We need to get something done.
Well, we've been speaking with Senate Finance Committee Chair Liz Krueger. She is a Manhattan Democrat. Senator, thank you so much for making the time.
Thank you.
Dave Lombardo from the New York Public News Network. We'll take a break, and when we come back, babies smell sweet, but teenagers stink. Teenagers have a reputation for smelling, well, just a tad bit funky. And according to the latest research, that stereotype might be rooted in solid science. Joe Johnson is here with that and more science stories next. This is Radio Chatskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Furniture Restore, located on Main Street in Jeffersonville. Specializing in antique and vintage furniture, rugs, art, and lighting, because buying well-made and pre-owned is a better choice for the planet. Winter hours online at therestorejville.com. And from The River Reporter, the community newspaper serving four counties along the Delaware River in Pennsylvania and New York, riverreporter.com. And from listeners like you.
This is Thane Peterson, host of Living Jazz. Saturday at noon, I bring you 2 hours of the very best of the current jazz scene, along with a little bit of classic jazz thrown into the mix. It's wonderful music that will warm your heart and soothe your soul. Join me for Living Jazz, noon to 2 Saturday, only on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Former Port Jervis science teacher and Radio Catskill volunteer Joe Johnson joins us to discuss some of the most fascinating science stories of the week, including stars eating planets, a fossil named after Kermit the Frog, and smelly teens. One of the ones that really caught my eye was in the New York Times, just because of this headline: toddlers smell like flowers, teens smell goat-like, study finds. What's that all about?
That's a headline that'll grab your attention. Well, this is a report of a new study that was in the Communications Chemistry Journal. This was done in Germany by a bunch of doctoral students. Previous research had shown that parents can recognize and find very pleasant the BO, the body odor, that's the technical phrase, of their own infants. And they think that this facilitates bonding between parents and children. I know my own experience, my kids smelled great when they were babies. I, you know, couldn't get enough of smelling them. But when they get to be teenagers, their BO changes, and it can be very off-putting to parents in particular. Now, BO is really complex stuff. It's the dozens of secretions from the skin that interact with the atmosphere. Some of them oxidize. Some of them are eaten by microbes on the skin and then re-emitted as a different gas. And so what these scientists wanted to do was they wanted to quantify the differences in the smells of the two groups, prepubescent and post-puberty. So they took a bunch of, 18 0-3-year-olds and 18 14-18-year-olds, prepubescent and postpubescent. And what they had them do was wear cotton pads in their armpits while they slept. They pooled the pads, all the 0-3 and all the 14-18, and then they analyzed the chemicals that they found in the pads that were secreted by the skin. And what they found is that there were a lot of compounds that were the same. You know, because we all give off a lot of the same chemicals. But because the teenagers had started to sweat, their secretions had a little bit different odor. So they used gas chromatography and mass spectral analysis, some pretty powerful science, and they looked at these compounds, and they found that teenagers had more carboxylic acid, which when you smell it in its pure form smells like cheese or smelly feet, it's been described as. They have perfumers that they were working with who had, you know, acute senses of a smell. But the teenagers also had two steroids in their sweat that the babies didn't, that the younger children didn't. And I won't bore you with their long chemical names. We'll just call them steroid one and steroid two. Steroid one smells like sweat and urine and musky. And steroid 2 smells like musk or sandalwood. And so what they found is that there's a very strong chemical difference. And of course, it's because of hormonal changes in the kids. But there's a very difference. Their sweat glands in teenagers are much more active.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, you mentioned that people like to smell babies, your own children, yourself.
Oh,
they smell really good. But then it takes a turn at some point, and now we kind of understand why. But the paper also was interesting. They said there's no universal way to determine odor, how it's pleasant for one person, maybe more pleasant for another person.
Yeah, odor is very subjective. And so even the perfumers were not in 100% agreement with each other.
But it's fair to say that teens are smelly.
They can be.
All right, let's move on. At least one in a dozen stars shows evidence of planetary ingestion. This was in Nature. What is planetary ingestion? Are we talking about planets eating one another?
Well, no, we're talking about stars eating planets.
Oh.
Okay. So what they did, this is a Australian-led research group. This was in the journal Nature. And they studied 91 pairs of main sequence stars using the European Space Agency's Gaia satellite. Now, a main sequence star is a star in its prime. It's what I call a cruise control star. It's burning, it's fusing its hydrogen into helium at a very steady rate. It's a very stable star. Now, these stars were very close together, and so they think that they were probably born at the same time. So they studied 91 pairs of these stars, and what they found is that in 7 out of the 91, that there was evidence that one of the stars had actually ingested a planet. Its spectroscopy, its spectrograph, showed that it had heavier metals in it, iron and nickel, which is more common to a rocky planet than it is to a star.
So does this mean that the star systems or solar systems or however we're defining it are less stable than once believed, maybe?
I don't know if that's a conclusion we can draw from this study.
Draw from it? Because it kind of scares me that stars are eating planets. Should we be worried?
I don't think we should be worried.
Okay.
Our own solar system is fairly stable now. Our own sun does have some metal in it, so that it shows that in the past that it has ingested, you know, either a rocky planet, a protoplanet early in the solar system's history, or perhaps some asteroid material.
So the stars that are eating these planets, ingesting these planets, is it because the planets are, I don't know, is it less stable, but is it how is it that they can eat the other one?
Well, when a star system first forms, there's a lot of chaos going on. And proto-planets are literally running into each other. We think the Earth was hit and that formed the Moon. We know that the Mars, I believe, was hit at one point. There's evidence for that. So there's a lot of things banging around in these early star systems. And so it's just this, like I said, it's a very small study. They are going to be studying more stars and see if that they will show this evidence too. Now, you have to remember that 91 pairs of stars, there's 100 billion stars in our galaxy. So this is the tiniest, tiniest sample.
All right, I won't worry about it. I don't understand it. I also don't understand teens, but I do understand Kermit the Frog.
Kermit the Frog.
And this is kind of cool. Scientists have named a newly discovered ancient amphibian species after Kermit the Frog. Well done, Kermit. And well done, scientists.
Well, this critter was discovered in some fossils that had been collected in Texas back in 1984 by the Smithsonian Museum of Natural History. And so they finally got around to looking at these, some doctoral students did, and they noticed one skull that was very different than any other skull they had seen of these amphibamiforms is what they called them. And it was kind of smushed to the side. By the way, this skull is only about 3 centimeters long or 1.5 inches long. So this is a tiny little skull, and it's not even a complete skull. But they looked at it, and it's kind of smushed, and it kind of gives it a lopsided grin. And here I have a picture I want to show you.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Can you see Kermit?
I can see Kermit.
So they named it Kermitops gratis. Ah. Kermitops for Kermit face in, you know, Kermit. We all know who Kermit is. And tops means face, or ops means face in Greek. And gratis is basically just saying thank you to the National Museum for letting them study this.
And so, you know, naming it after Kermit is cute and everything, but it also has a purpose. It helps kind of bridge this fossil, which is 270 million years old, to educate the public a little bit.
Sure, it absolutely. Anything
people have more interest.
A little more interest, absolutely, absolutely. Now, this is not the first time this has happened. There's a number of species. There's about 20,000 new species that get discovered every year on the planet. Lots of insects, lots of fish, lots of new species being discovered. But there's been a number of species that have been named after celebrities. Beyonce has a horsefly named after her, and the scientists thought that it had dense golden hair on its back, and so they named it after Beyonce. John Cleese from Monty Python has a lemur named after him. Kate Winslet has a beetle named after her. We all know about the plesiosaur that was recently named after David Attenborough. He was apparently somehow involved in its discovery. And the one I really like is the Prince Charles has a frog named after him. Or I should say King Charles has a frog named after him. They were recognizing him for his charity work in protecting the rainforest.
And, you know, it's about time that something gets named after Joe Johnson. When's that happening?
I don't know.
Always bringing us great science stories, Joe Johnson.
It's always
Thank
fun
so
to talk
much.
To you about it, Tim.
All right. And we'll take a break. And when we come back, we'll be with Sullivan County Democrat health and wellness columnist Maggie Fitzpatrick with her column Moving Toward Health. Today's subject, the secrets of great supporters. This is Radio Chatskill.
Last year, over 100,000 people died from drug overdoses driven by fentanyl. And the fastest growing group is under 19. Fentanyl is the number one cause of overdose in Sullivan County. Whether you're a parent or an educator, you can have the right conversation now to potentially save a kid's life. Protect kids from the dangers of fentanyl. More information and resources at naturalhigh.org. Paid for by Catholic Charities of Orange, Sullivan, and Ulster.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Maggie Fitzpatrick is the health and wellness columnist for the Sullivan County Democrat, and her column, Moving Toward Health, is out every Tuesday, and she comes by to tell us about it. She's here right now. Hi.
Good morning.
So this column is The Secrets of Great Supporters. Have you ever told someone about a goal or a dream of yours, and their first response was all of the reasons why it might not work out? Been there.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's pretty common, and I'm sure we've all been on the receiving end and on the giving end of that sort of advice.
Yeah, you have a great way to sort of think about having these conversations. And I hadn't really thought about it, I guess, until I looked at this. I was like, oh, that makes sense. But you also point out that this may be an odd way to approach it. So explain what you mean by this simple question you can ask with your partner or supporter.
Yeah. So it's really easy when someone starts telling us about something that they're excited about for us to just share what's ever on our mind about it. Right. And that doesn't really give them the opportunity to truly share what they're telling you, right? It makes it about us. And so when, you know, someone is sharing something with you, this can apply to anything, but I really like it in this context of, you know, goals and someone trying something new because it puts you in a really vulnerable position, right? Something really simple you can do is just ask them, like, what do you want from me right now? You know, would you like feedback? Would you like to just listen? Would you like me to just listen? And by asking a question like that and just trying to feel out what type of response they're looking for, we can make sure that we're on the same page and supporting them in a way that they want to be supported in, because we're not always open to feedback, right? Yeah. And sometimes we just want to share something with someone because we're excited about it, and we don't want them to, you know, rain on our parade, so to say.
Yeah, and it's you are, it's like you said, it's giving the person permission to give you what you're looking for.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. It helps us both.
Because you kind of come into this, people could do this a lot, I guess, without thinking that the expectation is, oh, they're going to listen to me, or oh, they're going to give me this, like without, oh, let's take a second to see how that person's feeling, where they're at.
Right. We just assume.
Yeah.
Right. We just assume on both ends that we know exactly what the other person wants because it's what we're thinking. Right. But a lot of times we're not actually on the same page. And so just asking a clarifying question like that actually builds a lot of trust and helps us both get on the same page. So that way we can have a valuable conversation where we both feel supported instead of tearing each other down. You know,
so actively listening. And then if you're that person who's been asked to actively listen, how can you provide that feedback? What are some kind of tips to think about?
So I actually didn't mention this in the article, but one thing that is really great is it's called matching, right? And so let's say you're telling me something you're really excited about, right? If I match your energy and I get excited about it with you, then that's going to make you feel heard and supported and seen, right? And understood. And if you're really excited, I'm like, oh, that's really cool. Then you're going to be like, oh, did you even hear me? Right? Do I even matter to you? And then it's probably going to spiral into, this person hates me. I can't, right? Like, and it goes into this whole conversation. So, that's one thing that I really like. But then another thing is, let's say you're sharing something with me that you want to do. And I'm like, oh, red flag, red flag, red flag.
Right,
you know,
right,
like
yeah.
This really isn't, I don't know if this is going to work out. Our instinct is to want to protect this person we care about, right? So I can say to you, are you crazy? Like, yeah. That's never going to work. And that response is going to make you feel very defensive. And like, you have to protect yourself because you're being vulnerable with me and I'm attacking you, right?
Right.
Where if I am feeling some sort of concern that I want to share, a great way to approach that part of a conversation would be for me to ask you if I can ask you further questions to understand your vision, right? Because truthfully, I'm making assumptions when I feel those fears about what you're sharing with me, right? Because I don't fully understand what you're saying. And so when I can ask you more questions and allow you to share more about what it is that you're seeing or that you want, then it gives me the opportunity to fully understand before I share my fears with you, right? And then if we still feel like, oh, maybe this isn't the best idea, it gives me the opportunity to maybe ask again, can I share my thoughts with you? And you say, yeah, of course. And then I can share them from a place that doesn't have you feeling threatened, which then means that you feel like I heard you and I supported you.
Yeah. And one of the things you mentioned in the column too is like being heard and understood is one of our biggest needs as humans. And that's on both sides, the person talking and the supporter.
Yes, exactly. And it might sound weird to say, can I ask you more questions? Right? That might feel weird to you. But truthfully, it's not weird in practice. It might feel weird for you to ask, but once you do, the other person who's receiving that is going to say, wow, you really respect me. And you are asking me if I'm okay with you asking me more questions. And it builds a deeper layer of trust.
It's about respecting the process, right? Respecting
yeah.
the, the person and the process.
Yeah. And that's the other thing is that everyone's going to have a different process. Even if you were telling me about a goal that you have that I've already accomplished, like let's say you say, Maggie, I want to run a half marathon, right? And I ran 2 half marathons. I could immediately say, oh, you need to train like this and you need to eat this and you need to do this on your race day. And you're going to say, what? Like, that's not what I was trying to share, right? And so I have to respect the fact that the way you're going to do it is probably going to be different than the way that I did it.
And the column is out today in the Sullivan County Democrat. It's on newsstands and also at scdemocratonline.com and includes a cute picture of you and your husband.
Yeah, we've had to work on this a lot, but it's something that
you were a supporter. Yeah, well, that's good.
At. Yeah.
All right, Maggie Fitzpatrick, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Several research studies have found evidence that writing or reading poetry can be therapeutic. Poetry can provide comfort and boost mood during periods of stress, trauma, and grief. The powerful combination of words, metaphor, and meter can help folks better express themselves and make sense of the world and their place in it. As part of its winter wellness series, Bethel Wood Center for the Arts is offering a poetry workshop tomorrow with Allison Green Myers, published author, poet, and program director for the Highlights Foundation in Boyd's Mills, Pennsylvania. New Radio Catskill contributor and Liberty Public Library Community Program Director Tracy Gates spoke with Allison Myers about the workshop and the comfort of words.
I'm excited to talk to you, Allison, because you're going to be giving a poetry workshop at Bethel Woods, part of the Winter Wellness Series. And as we know, we're into spring, although sometimes it's been feeling a little winterish lately. But I was just kind of curious why this was part of the wellness series, how poetry connects to wellness.
That's a great question. So one of the things in the winter wellness, they're looking for ways to kick off the new year. That's the winter wellness program is all about that. And looking at writing as an expression of yourself. And when I was asked if I would be a part of the winter wellness, poetry became the avenue that I really thought about because in this course in particular, we're going to talk about poetry as conversation. Mm-hmm. I think when we are really selective with our language, as we often are in poetry, you know, it can end up really focusing us on what we want to say. And so I'll be talking a lot about whether it's poetry as conversation with yourself, it might be conversation with your former self or future self. It might be poetry with the world, things that you're trying to send out as messages of hope or healing or joy, connections really. And I think that's something we all need to feel, whether it's a connection with our own selves or connections with others. And we're going to use poetry as that vehicle.
So I'm curious, have you offered this workshop at the center before or maybe somewhere else?
We happen to be sitting where I've offered this before.
So,
right, yes. Yeah, so, so I'm at the Highlights Foundation in Boyd's Mills, Pennsylvania, and I'm the program director here. And this summer, during one of our programs, I offered a similar lecture. I was working specifically with novelists who were writing for children, and I was talking about bringing your own experiences to your fiction for children and was using poetry kind of as the vehicle to have that conversation with yourself to bring those experiences forward. And so we did a series of exercises to open that up and used poetry as that vehicle.
So that leads me actually to the next question. What are some of the exercises that you might be using in this workshop this Wednesday?
Sure. Do we have time for a few poems? If we're talking about poetry, would it be okay?
Most definitely. Allison is also a poet, so I think we should, yeah, definitely listen to a little.
I'll read two things, kind of thinking about some poetry that we have at our fingertips. I really find poetry almost everywhere that we look, but I'm going to look at some published works, and I'm going to ask specific questions about entry points, because I think that's what a poet does. It finds the entry point, whether it's an entry point for yourself where you felt connected, or it's almost the doorway that you walked through and you get to experience something new. One of my favorite poets, Maggie Smith, from Maggie's collection, Goldenrod, I'm going to read a poem, and I think of this as a poem that it is a conversation. And so there's an entry point in this poem. While my experience isn't exactly the same, I'm going to share with you the entry point, and you'll kind of see what an exercise might look like. So we might read some together, talk about those entry points, and then do some writing and reflection together.
By the way, this is a beautiful book. It's called Goldenrod by Maggie Smith. Okay, and you're going to read the title as well.
Woman, 41, with a history of Alzheimer's on both sides of her family. Every night before bed, I lock the front door, but in the morning, I can't find those metal teeth, those brassy mountains, those little saws that lock it from the outside. I can't remember what they are called or where inside I set the memory of setting them down. In the night, I've jerked awake to the sound of footsteps and found it's only springs creaking in the mattress. When I breathe in, out, it's my own filling and emptying. No one's broken or entered. I still remember one night in the beginning of our brief life together, the neighbors left for the bar, and your roommate boosted me to an open window, climbing in behind. We took nothing, only rearranged the furniture. When they came home and found everything wrong, they must have sworn something was missing.
That's great. And of course, I'm noticing none of that really rhymes, but it has a lot of rhythm to it.
Absolutely, yes. And I think Maggie Smith's poetry is very narrative. It's storytelling in that small encapsulation. And so when I'm talking to adult writers about something like this, I might ask them about their entry points. Someone might say to me, my parent right now is, you know, has been diagnosed with Alzheimer's. And that is exactly how they describe a key or their glasses, those things that I look through that I'm not sure. It's again and again, it's that repetition. Repetition is such a part of poetry. It is rhythm. It is sound. It's what we're building upon. And, you know, for me, that was my connectivity. I didn't go to one of the pieces that Maggie Smith does in this poem is that flashback to former self. I crawled through that window. Remember that silly memory? My present self, which is, what is that thing called? My future self is, oh no, will this happen to me? Alzheimer on both sides. Mm-hmm. And so that's what's in the poem. But for me, my entry point was that repetition. I loved something about the sound. So when I sat down to think on that, my poem is called, Is There a Pause?
This is your poem, just to clarify that this is Allison's poem. Okay, take it away.
Sure, yes. Is there a pause? A pause, a stop, a shelter, a sabbatical, a substitute for daily life and endless grief. Pause, stop, breathe. I can't get through the moment without the catch in my throat, the prick at my eye, the pause, stop. I'm nearly there. Could I? Today feels like the first day you left all over again. All over. And at first, when I checked your breath, your throat, your eyes, held your hand, pause, stop, breathe. I'm not done with grief. He's not done with me. Is there a place to pause, stop? It's me and not you, and not you and me. It's me and others who watch me breathe and grieve all over again.
Wow, I love how you read that, and it is so much about rhythm. I'm curious, so something like this, could one write that in the length of a workshop, or is really the workshop a way to, like, you know, read poetry, discuss it, and then, I guess, what are your expectations? And I'm also curious, now, how long does it take you to write something like this?
Sure. So I brought this because this was the poem that I wrote when I sat down. I'm sure I went back and looked at it. There's something, especially when we're talking about this, we're talking about poetry as conversation with yourself. It's about your present moment, what you feel, what that point is. And, you know, we might take 10 minutes to do one of the prompts, and it might be something that you come back to. It might be a thread then that weaves into everything that we go to. And I won't walk around the room and say, oh, have you moved on to the next exercise? If I think so much about writing and art in general is about flow. And so if you're in the flow and you're coming back and saying, I'm looking for this word. I'm looking to do, you know, this, with the first poem we were working on. We'll stay with that. You know, that's what this is about. It's about your experience. Polishing something is different, right? Getting it ready for publication is different. This isn't ready for publication. This is a rush. This is emotion in connection to another poem. Maggie Smith's poem that I read first was ready for publication. It had all the loose ends tied up. It was ready to go. So, I would expect that part of it, as we're having this conversation with poetry, is really being together and having conversation in community about how people are feeling and where people are. And that might be what you take away, or you might take away words that you've written on a page.
You talk about coming together and community. So this is not online. This is you're going to meet all together at Bethel Woods. How many participants or students are in the workshop?
I think there's room for 20. I think we have 10 people signed up at this time. So it'll be a nice small group, an intimate group to have that conversation.
I'm also curious, because I'm sure if people are listening to this, they're thinking, oh, I love poetry, but I've never written poetry. What do you say to that?
Everyone has a time when they could say they've never written poetry, and then a time after they take the pen and do it. I think that it's open to the experience that you have. I think we'll be reading a lot. I'll bringing some of my favorite poets. Naomi Shihab Nye's coming, not with me, but on the paper with me. Billy Collins, Joy Harjo, Mary Oliver. Poets that I think really speak to the place where we live. We happen to live in this beautiful space. And so some of it will be the poetry that we're reading and discussing. And hopefully some of it will also be what we're writing and sharing, because we want to hear from others. I was at I love where we live. Like, I love the community events that we have here. I was at a wreath making drop-in at the Narrowsburg Union, you know, and it was silly. None of us knew what we were doing. We were, you know, wearing gloves because of the branches and needles that we were dealing with, and smelling, you know, the pine on our hands and laughing because we were such novices at it. I think everyone in that room would attest to it. And someone found an ornament, and the ornament that they were going to put on the wreath had a little dog kind of sticking out of the window. And someone at the table then said, oh, I just lost my dog. And almost everyone at the table was ready to be a part of that conversation with a perfect stranger, you know, but it was we wouldn't have had that connection together had we not done the thing that's really hard to do, which is leave our own space and connect with people that we don't know, and be willing to share. And that's what I love. Some things like here at Bethel with their educational programming in Narrowsburg, I'm always finding opportunities to, you know, go out and do things.
I work at a library, and I feel very, very similarly about that. It's when you're with people, that's when things happen. And then that's when, you know, you often want to create something from that or have an emotion that resonates. So, Allison, I know you're also an author, and the title of your book that came out in 2022 or 2021 the title is A Bird Will Soar, and I'm looking at a beautiful jacket cover. It's also out in paperback. Correct me if I'm wrong, but it's a middle grade novel, early teens, or 12, 11, 13, 14. I know that you incorporated poetry within this novel. I'd love to hear a little, maybe you can read one or two poems from that as well.
One of the things about the book, when I sold it, it was purchased as a novel in verse. So it was completely in poetry. My editor and I talked a lot about the expansion that was possible in the book. And I definitely couldn't imagine what it became. And so the book itself has prose, it has the narrative that runs through it, and then it has poetry and poetry adjacent chapter headings. I made up a complete bird encyclopedia. So the encyclopedia.
That is so great.
They're all, I actually named it A.P. Brown's Encyclopedia of Birds for my niece and nephew, Anna and Parker Brown. So they got their own encyclopedia. Actually, the copy editor reached out and said, I'm having a hard time finding your source material of A.P. Brown's encyclopedia. Oh, well, I made it up. So it was a way for me to involve so many things that I had in the poetry and metaphor that I had in the poetry that I lost a little bit of when I moved it into prose. And it also gave you insight into the people that are in the main character's world. The main character, Axel, loves birds. And so the encyclopedia is actually one of his most prized possessions, and he reads it very often. And then Axel's neighbor, George, is a collector of words. He loves poetry. And Mary Oliver happens to be his favorite poet. So there are many reasons that we dip into that. And then another poetry adjacent chapter heading that I have are emails that go back and forth between the director of the Delaware Valley Raptor Center and the main character, Axel, because Axel is checking in on updates of a rehabilitated eagle.
I guess I wanted to ask you a little bit about your background with writing and poetry. When did you start to write poetry?
It's funny. I do a lot of school visits as a primarily a writer for children. That is one of the questions they'll say, when did you know you wanted to become a writer? I wasn't a huge reader or writer that I thought of myself as when I was younger. My older sister was the, you know, editor of the high school newspaper. My older sister was the writer, you know. But then when I look back, I wrote a lot of songs when I was growing up. I was constantly writing songs. Songs are poetry. And I talk to kids a lot about the fact that story is really everywhere. I think of myself more like a experience or word gatherer. And I just so happen to decide to put it into books or poems, just like they might build story into a video game design, or they might build a story into a podcast, or, you know, something auditorial, or, you know, an oral storytelling. We like to tell stories as humans. That's something we like to do, but there's so many ways to do it. So I didn't really start thinking of myself as a writer until I was teaching. I was a classroom teacher, and I started really writing with my students, and loved it so much, and thought, well, maybe I would go back to school and try and learn a little bit more about this. And I attended the National Writing Project then, which is a project for teachers who would like to become writers. Mm-hmm. And it was a big change.
I just feel that having taken some writing workshops in the past, that taking a workshop with someone who, you know, is published and has so much experience, as well as you're a teacher as well. I mean, this is such a golden opportunity. Remind me again where people would go to sign up for this.
On the Bethel Woods website, there is a tab that's labeled events, and it doesn't just have the concerts, but it has the wonderful Bethel Woods educational programming that they offer. And there's more than this poetry class. I really hope that people will check out all the classes that they have.
Is there anything else, Allison, that we've missed talking about that you feel like, oh, I really wish I had talked about this?
I appreciate the time to talk about something, you know, I'm really passionate about. And I think it's words, you know, it's connecting with other people. And I think that's needed now more than ever.
I couldn't agree more. Allison, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us. And who knows, maybe I'll sign up for this.
I'd love it. I hope to see you there, Tracy. Thanks so much.
New Radio Catskill contributor Tracy Gates speaking with Allison Green Myers, a poet and author. That's all for this edition of Radio Catskill. More local news and culture on our website, wjffradio.org. And don't forget to listen to the local edition tonight at 6. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Radio Catskill supporters include SUNY Sullivan, a community college in the Sullivan Catskills focused on preparing students for the future. More information at sunysullivan.edu. Livingston Manor, dining, shopping, and the arts at the gateway to the Catskill Park. LivingstonManorNY.com. And listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Hey, it's Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Aisha Roscoe.
One of the things you can count on from NPR and this station, we've got your back. When it comes to reporting the news, bringing you facts you can count on. You can help by donating a vehicle you no longer need.
That car could be worth hundreds of dollars in support or more as a donation.
Think about it.
We accept any vehicle, running or not, including cars, trucks, boats, RVs, motorcycles, and more. Donate at WJFFradio.org.
WJFF Jeffersonville, W233AH Monticello. You're listening to Radio Catskill.